Welcome to What She Said, the heartbeat of Canadian women's voices, with me, your host, Candace Sampson. Here, we dive deep into the raw, unfiltered stories and triumphs of women from coast to coast. This isn't just a podcast, it's a movement where empowerment and education collide and where mansplaining is shown the door. We're here to celebrate, uplift, and echo you. So get cozy, tune in, and let's embark on this journey together, exploring the rich tapestry of women's lives, their battles, and victories, right here on What She Said. There is a crisis unfolding across the country, one that touches the core of our humanity and challenges the fabric of our society. It's the state of our healthcare system, especially its impact on the most vulnerable among us, our seniors. We are at a crossroads where the principles of compassion and care that should define our healthcare are being overshadowed by inefficiency and neglect. It's a reality that many of us may one day face, and for some, that day has already come. A reality that's not just disappointing, but downright heartbreaking. The stories are all around us, tales of vibrant lives diminished by a system struggling to uphold its promise. And it's these stories that bring us face to face with the human cost of our healthcare system's shortcomings. It's not a matter of policies or politics. It's about the very essence of who we are and who we aspire to be as a society. Enter Elizabeth Payne, a name some may recognize from her incisive healthcare journalism, a voice that has long echoed the complexities and challenges within our healthcare system. But recently, Elizabeth's professional world collided with her personal life in the most profound way, shedding light on the systemic issues through the lens of personal loss and resilience. Her poignant story detailing her father's harrowing journey through the healthcare system and published across postmedia is a powerful testament to the urgent need for change. It's this unique perspective forged in the crucible of personal experience and professional insight that Elizabeth brings to our conversation today. So as we dive into this discussion, let's remember that behind every statistic, every policy debate, there's a human story waiting to be told, waiting to be heard. So without further ado, meet Elizabeth Payne. Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Your article that was published in the Ottawa Citizen recently poignantly shares your father's story and its impact on your family. Can you walk us through what happened to your father and how the initial incident led to a series of healthcare challenges?
Yes. So my dad, first I'll say this is a very, very common story. So very sadly, my dad was living on his own. My mom passed away 5 years earlier. He was very independent, very stubborn. We would have liked him to be in a smaller place, but he remained where he was. He was driving, lived in a small town, was getting by. He had a little help coming in. And he made a trip to the bank. One day he drove there, liked to go to the bank a lot. They knew him there well. And while he was standing in line, he fell, as simple as that. And many people there knew him. They called an ambulance for him. And interestingly, in this story, the hospital he went to was 30 kilometers away because the hospital in town had been, the emergency had been shut down a few years earlier. So he headed down the highway to the hospital, got in and waited in line in its gurney, as many people do. So began, the doors closed, and what began was a whole series of the sort of circumstances that worsened the condition he was in.
Really, from the get-go, this was a system broken, that, you know, the ER was closed in the town. Can you remind me what year this happened again, when this all started?
Yeah, this was in 2022, so into the pandemic, a couple of years in. The hospital in town had been closed earlier, amalgamation. There remained an urgent care that since the hours have been shut down there somewhat. So the hospital down the road was the one he had to go to.
So when he fell, he broke his arm, correct?
That's right. Yeah, he didn't. Yeah, so we learned, you know, after his weight, he got into emergency and learned he had broken his upper arm. And he didn't have a head injury, which, of course, we worried about. He seemed otherwise to be fine. So it didn't seem like such a terrible injury. But, you know, they started investigating. When he got there, he had an extremely low heart rate, and rightly that was of concern. So he was immediately hooked up to all sorts of monitors to monitor his heart rate, keep an eye on what was going on. So he got there, and this guy who had, you know, driven his car that day was suddenly bedbound. And he was strapped to the bed because once he got over the initial sort of adrenaline rush of it all, he wanted to get out of there as fast as he could, and he couldn't.
And so what happened to his health then from the time he was admitted into the hospital? You mentioned that there was just sort of this series of mistakes and you know, I suppose, budget cuts that prevented proper care for him. What happened to his health as you watched this happen?
Yeah, I mean, it's a whole number of things. And it was, you know, to me, it just struck me because I've been writing about these as a health reporter, about overcrowded emergency departments because hospital beds are full and there's no place to move people, often older people like my dad. So there's long lineups. They're packed, about nursing shortages and possibly understaffing before nursing shortages, issues like infection control, the fact that there were outbreaks going on. So all those things he began to encounter, first from getting right into the emergency room and having to wait, and then being put in a room with curtains around him in a very noisy, somewhat chaotic, overly busy emergency department with bright fluorescent light shining down on him. And that was his room. And he was admitted to that, you know, room, which was a cubicle without walls. So all those things contributed to his inability to move. Really, there was no place to move in emergency. It was just, you know, it was overflowing with people and with, you know, not waste, but people trying to clear out the waste. And there wasn't a place to walk around. He was hooked up to monitors. And he began to show signs of delirium almost immediately, which is also a common kind of impact, particularly on older folks, that goes with injury and anxiety and stress of hospital stays. So that is another, like, all these chip away at his ability to be independent at some point. Eventually he was into a room, and there was an outbreak in that room. So, you know, things stopped, things kind of, you couldn't get up. You didn't have as much help. People were masked and gowned. So all of these chipped away at his ability to be mobile, and it doesn't take that long to lose your muscle mass when you're 90 years old.
And it wasn't just the physical deterioration, but there was also a big impact on his mental health, right?
Yeah. 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 I mean, you know, my dad was very independent. I think like many people that way age, he wanted to stay in his home. He wanted to remain independent. And I think he kind of avoided doctors in a way because of that, you know, and I think when it started sinking in that he had no independence, he couldn't get out as he wanted to and get in his car, that, you know, you become depressed, you become disoriented, it starts to sink in that you've lost your independence, you've lost your ability to make decisions for yourself. People go through these delusions where they see things and hear things, where, you know, a week before that wasn't who my father was.
And from the time he broke his arm until the time he passed away, how long was that, Elizabeth?
It was just over a year. And most of that was spent, or about half of that was spent in the hospital system, and a little over half was spent in long-term care at the end of his life.
So you're a health reporter, as you mentioned. How did this very personal experience, did it reshape your understanding of the healthcare system or sort of solidify that understanding for you?
No, I wrote in my story that I thought I understood the health system. If you were writing about healthcare when the COVID pandemic came along, it was, it was something like nothing you'd experienced before. And it was a time of intense focus and things going on. And that's what I was writing about. And then the subsequent years. And I had written lots about issues with staffing, about issues with infection control, about issues in emergency departments. I had done lots of stories, spoken to lots of people about hospitals and the stresses they were under. But I think I was seeing it on the macro level. And until my dad went into the hospital, I hadn't really seen what each of those little, you hear about them and they seem like bad experiences, but you don't see it as a continuum, that almost every day there's a little bit of that, and the way it chips away at a person's independence and their ability to ever get back to that independence.
Through your father's journey, you highlighted a lot of some systemic issues within the healthcare system, especially for the elderly. So based on your reporting and personal experience, what are the most pressing changes that need to happen right now for caring for aging patients?
Well, that's such a big question. I mean, my father's story was inside the hospital system. I sort of cringe when I hear this, but in Ontario, and I think elsewhere, they're known as ALC, alternate level of care patients. And these are patients who are in acute care beds, but they don't need acute care. They need either to go to long-term care or rehab or somewhere else, but there's no place for them. So, they've been unkindly termed bed blockers in the past. And their majority of them are elderly folks, not all of them. So the health system should and does in some way do a better job of preventing getting those people into those beds in hospitals. But the fact is, that population is a large part of the hospital population. And in some cases, there's a sense that, this shouldn't be our problem. And maybe that's unfair. But this isn't our real, these aren't our real patients. They're somehow, shouldn't be there. And in fact, they are there. Dr. Samir Sinha, a noted Canadian geriatrician who I spoke to, his take on it was that the Canadian hospital system was designed for 27-year-olds, which was the average age when it was designed. Now the average age is 72, and it hasn't adapted to meet those needs. And, the aging population is growing.
Hey there, it's Candace, and I've got a health tip that's too good to keep to myself. Ever heard of New Roots Herbal? Since 1985, this Canadian brand has been redefining what it means to be thorough. With an impressive team of scientists and over 8,000 square feet of advanced lab space, they test every ingredient 3 times to ensure you're getting the safest, most effective products on the market. So if you're like me and want the best for your health and for those you love, New Roots Herbal is the way to go. You can find their exceptional products exclusively at health food stores near you. Visit newrootsherbal.com to find a location in your area.
Have you ever thought, I'd love to have a podcast just like this one? Well, I can help. My name is Matt Kundle, and everyone at my company, the Sound Off Podcast Network, had a hand in making this show. Whether it was about the sound, the discoverability, or that you're just enjoying the show, we are all about the detail. If you think you have a podcast in you, reach out to me via email, matt@soundoff.network, or check out the website and become one of the great podcasts we work with at soundoff.network.
I was struck reading the article about, you know, there's this disconnect between what we know is good for the patient and what actually happens for the patient, which is largely because of underfunding and, you know, understaffing. What are the things that should have happened for your father?
Yeah.
I mean, but let's just start with, you know, obviously the emergency being opened in town where he was would have been the first step. But what else should have happened?
Yeah, and that's a whole other part that I would like to talk about as well of the story, the sort of geopolitics of medicine. But, you know, what should have happened, I spoke to Dr. Samir Sinhan at his hospital at Mount Sinai in Toronto. They've pioneered something called ACE, acute care for the elderly, and their priority is to keep people moving. And that can happen anywhere. He claims you don't need a lot of staffing to do it. It's just more of a priority. And that could be getting people, just making sure they're not lying down, because lying down within 8 hours, an elderly person's skin can start to get damaged. And that can lead to pressure sores, which can lead to, you know, very severe outcomes. So it's a matter of between having volunteers and staff who make that their priority, making sure patients get out of bed for meals, walk every day, have really limited their use of catheters, IVs, to give people fluids, which is often just done, whereas many people can pick up a glass and drink. And those things keep people from getting out of bed. They believe it's more important for people to get out of bed and walk around and not have those. So you might need someone there to help them with that. But those things make huge differences in how well people do in the health system. And it can be done anywhere. He says it's hard to redesign a system. And I think it is, you know.
I think, though, you know, reading your story, and I mentioned to you prior to this interview that, you know, I have a very dear friend of mine, her father passed away from a pressure wound in the hospital. This is something that most people will go through with their parents at some point, but I think we are wholly unprepared for that moment when it comes. And so you mentioned the importance of advocacy for patients. How can families effectively advocate for their loved ones within the structure that we currently have? I mean, it feels difficult, but perhaps not impossible.
I think that's true. And I'm actually not sure I'm the expert on how to advocate, because I almost found in our experience, you know, my dad was so much better off. There were a lot of us, we were around all the time, but it was almost as if something had, you know, just gone before you could kind of digest what had happened. And the next, so yeah, it can be very tough to advocate when there's not a lot of people around. It can be very tough to reach the people who make decisions. However, advocating makes a huge difference. They will listen to you. People are genuinely, those I have met who work in the health system are compassionate, want to do the best for patients, sometimes often know they can't do the best for patients. But if you know, make a point about what your loved one needs and they can do that, they will do that. So it's unfortunate for people who don't have advocates.
How did you and your family cope during this time? Did you have support systems in place? Did you, from, you know, because of the knowledge you had, reporting on healthcare, did you have any information that was helpful to you during this time?
Well, we had each other. I think we were lucky. You know, I have three sisters. We all eventually ended up, when none of us lived near my dad, we all ended up staying there. It was a small town. We knew lots of people in town who were also part of the support. And I think I understood a little bit, you know, my dad and his roommates at rehab all got COVID. We were able to push to make sure they got Paxlovid, which the elderly generally get. And they were, surprisingly to us, kind of reticent to give it to them, but they did. So I think that lessened their symptoms and helped prevent, you know, worsening health issues. But yeah, it was, you know, we had each other. It was tough. It's exhausting. You know, it's exhausting watching someone when you're at the point when you know that there's no getting out. So it's very sad. And my dad was in pain, and you know, it's not fun to see that. You try to distract him, really, which we did.
Pulling out sort of to that macro view again, you've been reporting on healthcare for how long?
Oh, long time, probably, I don't know, 15 years or so.
And in that time then, you know, obviously, I think this is a no-brainer. You've seen the healthcare system decline in Canada, but what are your feelings on how we are equipped for the aging we're seeing right now? We are seeing the boomers, literally, this is going to be the next 10, 20 years. We're going to be watching this sort of influx into long-term care facilities, into hospitals. We have a shortage of doctors. You know, how do we approach all that? How do we take care of this?
Yeah, I don't think we are prepared at all. You know, there was a lot of focus on the long-term care system, of course, during the first year or so of the pandemic, during those horror stories about what some homes went through. Whether that has fixed that, I'm not sure. There's lots of new buildings going up, but then other ones are closing. So, I'm not sure that side of the story has been fixed, but the acute care, no, the acute care is in crisis right now, and the number of elderly in it is an issue. I think the bigger picture is sort of the community supports for people. I mean, that's the thing. If you can get community supports, help in your home easily, you can stay home. And we know that. People have been talking about that for years and years, but it's just, the system is kind of overwhelmed right now. And perhaps, one of the stories I frequently cover is the sort of collapse of family health care. And I think for the elderly, that's actually a pretty important place to start. You might end up seeing a geriatrician for a specialty, but if you have a strong tie with a family clinic, I think that clinic has access to some care and home care, I think that makes a huge difference for people. That's not there right now.
It's interesting, you know, my parents are aging, and we're having a lot of discussions right now about sort of where they will go, and will we, you know, will they live closer to me, and how are we going to work all this, and where will we live? And one of the things that came out about it is that we can't really move too far from where we are because they don't want to lose their family doctor. And There are millions of people across Ontario without a family doctor. The wait list is up to 8 years for some people. And so this is having impacts beyond even just, you know, their health. It's limiting where we can move or live right now. And I think that's a big problem for people too.
I think that is. I mean, yeah, I think they're right to be concerned about their family physician. And one of the things that I think is a really undercovered story, down where my dad lives, it's, you know, close enough but far enough from the GTA that a lot of people have sold their houses in the GTA and moved down to the Niagara area, where it was, you know, somewhat cheaper and a little more rural. So there's, you know, nice housing developments where healthy retirees are moving by the dozens, and yet you think, there's all these populations being drawn here, and there's just not a good hospital system nearby. And that happens everywhere, and all through the country, there's areas that are sort of trying to draw retirees, and just look at your choices for hospitals. They're not close, and the ones that are close are probably teetering right now. So it's tough. It's a real problem.
Okay.
CareToKnow.ca is a free resource where Canadians receive the latest health information, updates on new and existing treatments, and advice from Canadian doctors via email. After enrolling at CareToKnow.ca, you'll receive accurate and reliable information from trusted Canadian medical experts delivered directly to your inbox. Members can also access the website for information on a variety of health-related topics. Through resources like vodcasts, podcasts, and live webinars, Canadian experts discuss how to manage a number of medical conditions and provide the latest knowledge and advice to help you make informed decisions about your family's health with your own healthcare provider. To sign up and start learning more about the health matters that impact you most, enroll in CareToKnow.ca today.
Hi, I'm Steve Yerko.
And I'm Tara Sands. Now available from Maji Media is our new podcast, 4Kids Flashback. 4Kids is the company who brought you the English dub of Pokemon in the late 90s and so many other shows like Yu-Gi-Oh!, Shaman King, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Kirby, the infamous One Piece dub, and so many more.
We'll be talking to the people who worked at 4Kids. Actors, directors, writers, editors, producers, engineers, you get the point. And hopefully get the answers to questions both you and I have about the company.
I actually worked there as a voice actor on some of the shows.
And I was a kid watching the shows and remember way more than Tara does.
And thank God for that. Steve is actually a professional storyboard artist, which gives some really unique insights into anime and animation. Subscribe today wherever you get your podcasts. That's the number 4Kids Flashback.
You've reported on, the Ebola vaccine. You look at a lot of different things, COVID-19. Do you ever look at systems that are doing healthcare for seniors right? Like, are there any countries that you know of that have a good grasp of this?
I haven't reported on that so much, but I know there have been reports on European countries that do a really good job with long-term care or retirement living, where there's a much more person-centered, and there's lots of work at local long-term care homes as well. Not lots, maybe, but some. There is an understanding of what makes a good retirement community. I mean, there's some co-ops across Canada that are doing that. There's some individuals. In fact, one of my former doctors and some friends have sort of set up a building where they live, the three of them, as they age, and it's made room for them to age and maybe have help in. There's lots of different ways people are doing that, but generally it's sort of the companies that are running the big businesses. The bottom line can be a problem in terms of how much care you get. I mean, I think there's a real push for better guidelines on how many hours a day people should get of care and that sort of thing, or how many nurses and our RPNs should be available. So there's lots that can be done. A lot of places do it better than us. Our long-term care did excessively poorly during the pandemic compared to other countries. So I think that shocked many people how badly, how high the death rates were and how badly we did.
Do you think this is a question of, private healthcare, private healthcare could do it better? Or is it just because the public system is so underfunded?
Well, in long-term care, absolutely that's not the case. There's lots of research from Canada and elsewhere showing that private long-term care, the outcomes are far worse. So there's no question. I mean, the long-term care my dad ended up in was municipally run. And it was pretty good. So not for profit and municipally run in this province do much better than the private care clinics. Generally, not always. There are always exceptions. But throughout the pandemic, that was the case. There's been lots of research underscoring that.
Do you see any hopeful signs or initiatives out there that might lead to better care for elderly patients in the future right now? Or is it just a mess?
No, I don't think it's a mess. I think there's, there's lots of people who know what works. Individuals know intrinsically what works as well. I mean, I think the move it and lose it or lose it motto has to just become something that people really understand with the elderly and the elderly understand as well. I mean, I'd say the sad thing about my dad was that was his motto in life, perhaps, you know, to his detriment at times even, but he firmly believed that a walk could fix anything, or he could get on his bike even perhaps when maybe that wasn't so smart anymore. But he was kind of done in a system that just said, no, you're not moving. And, you know, I'm like my dad. I also think a walk can fix many things, and I can't imagine that being denied to me if I was still able to do it.
What lessons would you like people to know about your experience, if just, you know, if they're going to be going through this or are currently going through something like this, what would you share with them?
Well, I mean, what I hope my story shared, because, you know, as I say, often in healthcare, you write about these exceptional cases, these stories of people who have these unbelievable health challenges. My dad's story was a story that happens every day in this country, in every hospital. I think what I have heard from people, and I think what I hope, is that it put a human face on this population that gets, you know, overlooked, becomes sort of dehumanized through the system because they can't deal with them. So as everyone knows individually, you know, these are humans, and I hope to do that. And also, you know, draw attention to something that is so common that often it's not seen as an issue and it should not be happening. I mean, it's contributing to loss of mobility, loss of independence, even death in many cases. So it shouldn't be happening.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining me today and sharing your story. I'm going to link to the article you wrote in the Ottawa Citizen. Was it published anywhere else, or was it across all post media?
It was across post media.
Okay, yep. Perfect.
So, yeah.
Okay, excellent. So I will put the link to that on the website when this goes live. Thank you for joining me. Where can people follow along with your health reporting?
At the Ottawa Citizen, which is theottawacitizen.com. I'm also on Twitter at EG Payne. So you should find me there. But post media, also throughout the post media chain, my stories are often published.
All right, wonderful. Thank you for joining me today, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
If today's podcast resonated with you, spread the word and share the inspiration. Don't forget to hit subscribe on What She Said across your favorite podcast platforms. Crave more? Join my vibrant community by signing up for my newsletter at whatshesaidtalk.com. And let's get social on Facebook, Instagram, and X at What She Said Talk. Dive into my world a little deeper on TikTok and Threads at Candace Said. And for those who love the airwaves, catch me weekly on 105.9 The Region, Blast the Radio, and 107.7 Pulse FM. Until next time, keep making waves, and remember, your voice matters.
I'm Connie Thiessen, the host of Broadcast Dialogue, the podcast. We focus on Canada and the challenges facing Canadian radio and TV, as well as highlighting those moving the industry forward, from podcasting and streaming to new broadcast tech. Check us out at BroadcastDialogue.com or your favorite podcast app.
I'm Jeff Woods, and I'm shining a light on music and the rock stars who make it.
He just was one of those people. He stood out.
He was a magic guy. He really was a magic guy. We all have force. He had the same amount of force as we all had.
This was before Led Zeppelin. Robert was full on. I mean, he was Led Zeppelin without the band behind him. He had the hair, the jeans, the whole thing, you know. And he was amazing.
The Records and Rockstars podcast, heard around the world and yours to hear wherever you get podcasts. All the episodes from JeffWoodsRadio.com.
Another Sound Off Media Company podcast.